Lunch with Leon.
Hello and welcome to Lunch with Leon. Not just any episode. This is molten podcast gold as we reach our centenary episode 100. And because it's such a special episode, we have to have a special guest. And this episode's special guest is none other than Peter Lord Hendy of Richmond Hill of Imber in the county of Wiltshire, Minister of State for Rail in the present government, previously Chair of Network Rail, and before that, Commissioner for Transport in London. So with such an extraordinary career, going back now a considerable period, you won't be surprised to know that my first question to him was actually, why, given all of his great achievements, did he accept this really tough job in the government?
So, I think the answer is, there are two answers, and they're both really simple. One of which is that I was sitting at my desk at home on a sunny Sunday afternoon last July, and my phone rang and it said no caller ID. And of course, actually, you know this, Leon, which is that you answer those calls because in the old days it used to be the mayor who was either unknown number or no caller ID. But it wasn't the mayor. It was a voice said, this is the number 10 switchboard and the Prime Minister wants to speak to you. And I thought, gosh, if I had a tie on, I would have straightened it, but I didn't have a T-shirt and a pair of shorts on. And after a bit of delay, I got Keir Starmer on the phone, and he said, I'd like you to be the Rail Minister in my new government. And I just said, I'd love to do that. Of course I will, because actually you wouldn't. I can't imagine any circumstances where you wouldn't either immediately accept it or have an excellent reason not to. So that's the practicality of it. The real reason, I suppose, is that I joined, I left TfL in July 2015 in a very short process to appoint a new chair of Network Rail not long after it was put into public ownership. And I chaired Network Rail, as it turned out, for not quite 9 years. But for the last six of those, following the timetable crisis of May 2018, it was quite apparent to me that the railway needed reform. It didn't work properly. And when it went really badly wrong, nobody was really in charge of it. That's what Chris Grayling, when he was the Secretary of State for Transport, found. The buck stopped with him. Now, you'll know, Leon, and as I did, that at TfL, when things went wrong, it was in the end our fault as the management. There was nobody else to blame, nowhere you could go and say, oh, well, we did our job, but they didn't do theirs. And I thought that was a good thing. I don't think it made our life particularly easy, but I think that it operated the system for the people of London and for the Mayor of London pretty well. My experience on the railway is that nobody's ever been able to say that because the whole system is so unduly fragmented that nothing is ever anybody's responsibility without calling in others. And the consequence of that is that the culture of blame in the railway, the first thing you do when you get up and you run a public transport system is to look at your phone and find out what's gone wrong, what's going on. And in TfL days, as you well know, you would pick it up in the morning, look at it and think, I better sort all this lot out because there's nobody else to blame and I'm responsible for this. And if I don't fix it, the mayor will get on to me and expect me to do something. So I'll do it first. On a bad day at Network Rail, it was very tempting. And indeed, occasionally I did look at it and I thought, oh, thank goodness this isn't us. Thank goodness this is a train company problem with staff or rolling stock. And that's an entirely the wrong way to think about it. And what we need with railway reform is to find people who are in charge of bits of the railway who say, this is mine and we need to fix it. That to me is what railway reform's all about. That to me is what the last government especially should have done. They said they were going to do it and didn't. And frankly, given the opportunity of playing a part in actually fixing the railway, I feel it's really important for me to do it. So here I am as the Minister for State for Rail in the new government. I've taken a pretty large pay cut to do this. It's not quite what Sue, my wife, thought I would be doing now. I didn't think that I would ever get the chance to do it. But given the chance to fix the railway, I think it would be pretty, well, it would have been unthinkable not to take the opportunity. And so that's what I'm doing.
Sure. The things that you did with us in TfL, I use probably in
every week in my walk of life. So I'm talking to you from a hotel in Baku in Azerbaijan. And yesterday I met the minister. In fact, he's the minister for digital and transport. And he said to me, what is the one thing I should tell my people to focus on? And I said, a rigorous attention to detail. So that's your story about every morning on the network, because normal business theory is that stuff is filtered upwards. So the person at the top only does strategy and blue sky thinking, and all that other stuff is delegated all the way down. But in our TFL time, woe betide anybody below us who didn't know what we knew. Because if we...
Absolutely.
And I think it is such a difference. Now, rigorous, as I said to the minister here, rigorous attention to detail means every day you get a chance to do it better than yesterday. And if you keep that on a compound basis, eventually the whole place does get better.
Well, and I think that, you know, customers, passengers of transport networks are pretty demanding. And actually they expect of the people who run them that they actually understand what's going on. I knew, I haven't seen him recently, but Justin King of Sainsbury's. I said to him once, you know, at your annual general meeting, do you get shareholders who come up and say, why isn't the coffee next to the cornflakes in the supermarket? And he said, no, we don't do anything like that. We deal with business strategy and how much margin we're making. And I said, well, my business isn't the same, because wherever I go or wherever I went at TFL, question three, even if you're talking about 20 years transport strategy for London, question three was always, why doesn't the Piccadilly line stop at Turner Green except in the evenings and on Sundays? And if you didn't have an answer to that question, which was not only a good answer but an accurate answer, people thought you were no bloody use. And I don't blame them, actually, because people want to feel that that the people who run transport systems use them, know what they're like, and understand the views of the passengers who have to travel every day. And I think I do know that. I've literally just come from a meeting of about a dozen MPs who want to know why Northern Trains is not running a good service. Now, I know why Northern Trains is not running a good service, even as the minister, because I spent quite a long time on it in the past few weeks. And I know I'm not fixing the answer, but I know what the answer should be, and I'm able to describe the steps that we're going to take to get there. And I think those things are important, because you're not just some faraway person with some grand title. Those people are receiving letters, as I do, from ordinary passengers saying, what's gone wrong? Why don't you fix it? And I think you ought to know what's gone wrong and why you should fix it, you know?
As I say, it's an upside down business theory. But of course, the transport sector as a whole, including aviation, rail, bus, is unusual, because Sainsbury's doesn't have a sort of Sainsbury's enthusiast club that follows its every move. In the way that in transport you always do, there are people around the world who know where all the planes are, what fleets they are, what seating configuration they've got, where they are and where they should be. Ditto for rail, ditto for bus. So we've always got uniquely that side group of people who probably know more about the business than anybody in it. And they do it voluntarily because there's just something about transport that makes them interested.
Well, and I think it's a good thing. I mean, you'll recall, and I know that you say this just as I do, when we entered the bus industry in the 1970s, one of the things that was pretty clear in London Transport is that you shouldn't really be an enthusiast. It was looked down on. And I could never understand that. And I like employing people who are enthusiasts, because I like their quest for knowledge and their detailed knowledge and experience. And I think that, frankly, that adds something, you know. And I haven't been to every railway station in Britain. I mean, nobody. Well, there are people who have, but they haven't done anything else in their lives apart from do it. But I know most parts of the country. Quite often, I know the train services people are referring to. And I try to say that I know a bit about this. I don't know everything, because people want some empathy. You know, they're making journeys sometimes which are very badly disrupted, and they want to feel that the people in charge of it understand both what's gone wrong, how it might affect them, and what might get fixed, you know. And we were pretty good at that in London, weren't we, actually? There weren't many parts of the bus network that you know, if somebody said the 238's gone wrong, you probably had a reasonable idea where it was, and you might even know why it had gone wrong, you know.
Indeed, which is why I'm intrigued, because we're often now faced with this thing about how do we make transport a career of choice for young people? Because if you think about what we're up against social media influencers and software writers and gaming jobs and all the rest of it. And then all at the other end of the scale, all the really exciting stuff in financial services and business analysis and so on. And sort of transport always comes as a really fourth, fifth level of interest. And I even remember in our TFL graduate recruitment days, which was some time ago, when you were interviewing people, we really weren't their first choice, but they thought they'd better come along. And even if you press them further, they sort of just about said they might be interested in strategy and planning. And I think we face this terrible thing, don't we, for young people, for what is really a fabulous industry. It's like the biggest family you were ever part of. It's got things that you can do which make a real difference tomorrow, as well as next week, next year, and all the rest of it. And everything we do is real and not virtual. I'm still struggling, if you like, how we write that and present it in such a way that we're not the fourth choice, but we're the first choice for careers for young people.
So I think, I mean, you can break it down a bit into sections, can't you? It isn't an obvious choice of people, but the first thing you can say is that actually it's an industry which has a pretty good chance of survival for the working life, even of an 18-year-old or 16-year-old who leaves school now. And that you can't say of many industries. You know, my wife's parents worked for Barclays Bank. You thought working for a bank was as safe as houses. Her father was the Barclays Bank manager in Exmouth. I don't suppose there's a bank manager in Devon now, and there's certainly nobody, you know, if there is a bank in Exeter, it's only got a couple of people who take cheque deposits. So, but the transport industry is going to endure, isn't it? There's no chance that there won't be significant numbers of people running public transport and certainly the railway, which as it needs less people to do basic jobs, but that's been replaced by technology, which not many people know about, but which is actually tremendously exciting. So it's a solid career. Much of the transport industry's still got extraordinarily good pensions, actually, by national international standards. Then secondly, it doesn't present in the way that it should. I mean, what you and I know is that once you admit that you work in a transport industry, you're never on your own at a party, are you? You know, you're surrounded by people who say, why does the Northern Line run the way it does? Why doesn't the Piccadilly Line stop at Turning Green, except in the evenings and on Sundays?
And why is the Circle Line not a circle?
Absolutely. You know, what's wrong with the Route 19? And people are interested in that. And if you can say a bit about it, they're even more interested because, you know, these are big, complex systems, and finding somebody who understands a bit. So that only works when you're in it. But once you're in it, you get those questions whether you're at the entry level in the organisation or right at the top. Then there's a question of people. And actually, we don't make as much of that as we should. The people who work in transport are absolutely fascinating. And still it's true, and it's certainly true on the railway, that many of them get in there by accident. They look for a job. They don't really know what to do. There's jobs as customer assistants on the tube or on stations. And suddenly they discover, as you described, this lovely world of really interesting people of diverse cultures and backgrounds who are really keen on the job they do. It's not actually a job; it's a vocation, I think. And people are committed to it. And you'll recall that even the most militant people on the underground, when it started to snow, attendance went up. They thought, oh gosh, it's going to get really bad for our customers today. We better make a special effort to come in, which is great, isn't it?
Also, there are not many other industries where you might get a chance to work inside the Olympic Games. You might get a chance to work on the planning or the delivery of the funeral for Her Majesty the Queen. I mean, these are all high-profile jobs where most of the world is watching on the television. And people who worked with us were actually doing it. And they've, for the rest of their lives, they've got that wonderful memory and experience and stories that, frankly, if you worked in a ball-bearing factory or even in the management of a ball-bearing factory, you probably wouldn't have that to talk about.
Absolutely. You know, I mean, what a privilege it was to work during the Olympic Games. and actually in both your case and mine, what a reservoir of knowledge it's given you to advise other people how to do it as well. But at the heart of it, there were loads and loads of people out on magenta tabards on stations and in the Olympic Park, and what a great time they had. They didn't expect to, but they did, and everybody was happy, you know. Yeah. So, you know, those experiences are great. And I'd say two more things. I mean, one of which is these industries are actually in the eye of technological change. It's not an optional extra. You know, if you look at the railway, it's got everything from Victorian signal boxes with levers that you pull with your entire force of both hands, right up to and including the ECTS signalling system that we Network Rail, or rather they Network Rail, are now putting on the East Coast Main Line, which is absolutely world-class modern technology. And anybody getting involved in that end of signalling will have a job for the rest of their life, because that's going to be the way railways are signalled throughout the world. And if you look at the bus industry has been absolutely in the vanguard of both hybrid vehicles and now full electric vehicles and hydrogen vehicles, in a way that the car industry and the truck industry is frankly only now catching up. So, you know, actually those are significantly really interesting reasons for a career. And then very lastly of all, for an increasingly recognised neurologically diverse community, our joint friend Phil Swallow, you should get him on here sometime and talk about it. He said to me, why do you assess people who are going to compile railway timetables in the same way as you assess people who work in an office? And I said, I don't know. And he went down to talk to the recruitment people and the people who do it. And the result is that we look for now people to compile railway timetables who are neurologically diverse, but who have minds that can cope with numbers and can see timetables in a way that, well, I can just about do it because I'm a bit on the spectrum, and you might be too, but not in the way that you can get somebody who can compile the West Coast Main Line timetable. And that needs a degree of human intervention in it, and it needs people whose brains will make that work. And I think it's so fascinating to find an industry that can embrace all those things. And by the way, in the course of it, if what you always wanted to do was to drive a bus or drive a train, you can get a job doing that as well.
Indeed. And you remind me, you remember I had a time visiting GCHQ. In fact, the intellect that exists in GCHQ has a profound effect on the entire population in the area. Everything from the libraries to the schools to the shops, because there's a huge concentration of neurologically diverse people with great intelligence working together. And oddly, because code breaking is akin to music, they told me there that at GCHQ they have a waiting list to join the orchestra, but they can't find 11 people to make a football team, which just goes to show you what happens when you bring people like that together in a place and look at the output. And your point on transport is we bring those sorts of different people together, and together they make an amazing output.
Of course, you know, I think it's wonderful, really. And if you look at, you know, the contribution of public transport in London and the country to society has been absolutely huge. Andrew Haynes and I were and are so proud to have the Windrush Memorial on Waterloo Station, not only because that's the place that people first turned up. If you ask Baroness Floella Benjamin, that memorial's within sight of her, of the platform that she first arrived at Waterloo at as an immigrant, but also because those people made such an incredible contribution to the transport both then and now.
No, for sure. So what we're saying, of course, is firstly, you don't just have to be a computer geek to be in transport. You can be from any walk of life, from any background, because there is a job in transport for you. But more importantly, if you're good at it, you'll probably get a better job. And there are those who started out as drivers and end up as managers. There are those who start out in planning and end up in some sort of strategic role and so on. Not only pensions, not only the excitement of doing something really important, but the route upwards is extraordinarily strong. If you're good at what you do and you get recognized, you will get up the ladder.
Absolutely. So I say two things to every large group of people I speak to in this job, and indeed in the last one. One of which is I started as a graduate trainee and I wound up as the commissioner, and now I'm a government minister. That's an extraordinary journey. Another one is that actually virtually every job I got was the result of organisational change, because that happens. And actually, when you see it, you should welcome it and not resile from it, because it's a good thing. But actually, these industries are such that if you join, then you've got a fair chance, if you're willing to train to do something different, sometimes to move where you do it, and sometimes occasionally to change employer, you've got a job for the whole of the time that you want to work in your life, which is extraordinary, actually, because there's not many places that, you know, there are not many industries like that you can say that about now.
No. There are not many people like you and I who have been employed all our lives, because thanks to transport, there's always been a job for people like us to do. Now, some of that is luck, some of that is timing, but in fact, there'll be jobs in transport at every level and with every skill requirement for as far into the future as we can see.
Oh yeah, and look for, you know, when after I'd learned to drive a bus, which is a whole different story in itself, because I learned to drive without London Transport and then had great difficulty in persuading London Transport that in fact I could drive, even though I had a license, because if you didn't drive their way, they didn't want you to drive at all. But I kept a license for years in the belief that actually, if anything terrible ever happened, I could go back to driving a bus. And of course, you and I still can. We don't need that cushion now, but that's one of the things that this job has given me, which is always, when I felt difficult about things, it always gave me I knew I had the chance to earn money.
No, for sure. And is there anything we need to do, though, with all this technology change? Are we making enough noise at the universities and schools to make sure that they are outputting people with more of the skills that we probably need? Because I have a terrible feeling, as ever, that education is always some years, if not generations, behind the requirements of today's employers.
So it's interesting. I mean, you know, I don't know whether you've had Mike Brown on your podcast or not, but Mike, of course, is really keen on apprenticeships. He followed me at CFL as the commissioner, and you work for him. And I sense that there's a bit of a change in the market with young people, which is there are still young people who want to go to university. And when they do, whatever subject they did, actually, you and I both know the standard script, which is you've done all this stuff now. If you want to join us, you're going to learn actually how to do a job and what we need you to do. But there are also a lot of people who want to go straight from school to employment, and apprenticeships are a way of doing that. I'm sort of less bothered what people get taught at school. What I think we need at all the levels in these organisations is people whose minds are open to interesting things, who can develop, you know, subjects and get interested either in people or technology or systems. So I'm less bothered about what people are taught at school, but I would like them. I mean, I'd love them to have both the school experience and the home life that says, well, now, you know, now I'm looking for employment. What interesting things can I do?
It really must appeal to people, young people, who are interested in climate change, interested in air quality, because what we are doing in transport, the widest transport, is we're leading the march on improved air quality and the consequences of climate change by everything that we do. Moving people onto public transport, of course, but developing the cleanest and greenest vehicles that we possibly can across road, rail, and indeed in aviation.
Well, I think it's really exciting. And actually, both of my kids, who are now in their 30s, I'm shocked to discover regularly, are far more conscious about the environment and want to make sure that the world they're living in is sustainable. And I think I agree with you. It is really exciting. And actually being part of something which is green, is getting greener, both wherever you look in transport, on rail, on road, and as you say, in the air and maritime, there's some really, really exciting things going on, and the transport industry is in the vanguard of it. You know, I mean, in yours and my time at TfL, we moved from an entirely diesel engine bus fleet to one where nobody would ever have believed that you could have a 100% electric double-deck bus or a hydrogen double-deck bus. We've done both. It's now commonplace. I'm taking the buses bill through Parliament currently, and one of the provisions in it is to enable there to be a cut-off date when new vehicles can't be used on local bus services except if they're zero emission. I mean, we couldn't have envisaged that 10 years ago, but it's very possible. In fact, it's certain at some stage in the not too distant future, isn't it?
Absolutely so, and I'm really excited about it because that gives us another reason to exist. We are, by getting people to travel with us, they are themselves contributing to improved climate conditions. And by all the work we're doing, we make the way in which they travel cleaner and greener in the process. I just think that's tremendous. However, of course, we can't leave the point about decarbonisation without talking about transport heritage, because you and I are deeply involved in transport heritage across a whole wide range of activities. But one of the challenges that comes with that is delivering transport heritage in a decarbonized way. So I guess I've got two points on this. One is transport heritage of itself is a very good thing, isn't it? Because of the way in which makes people feel warm and comfortable about their past, their predecessors, their grandparents, so on. And the other one is we've got some challenges to be able to continue to deliver that warm feeling deep inside with old petrol and diesel vehicles.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, we're you and I are absolutely at one with this, which is that there is transport heritage is not just nostalgia. Some of it is nostalgia, and it's not just frivolous and trivial. It relates people to their lives and to the lives of their predecessors. You know, their families in a very tangible way. You know, I look at, I don't know, there's a Facebook site for old Ealing, because I grew up in Ealing, and more often than not, the pictures that appear on it are of the 65 bus and of the 607 trolley bus down the Uxbridge Road. It relates people to their surroundings, so it's a good thing. And actually, you know, you're the chair of the London Bus Museum. That's a brilliant thing. We've both been trustees of the London Transport Museum in our time, and they're telling stories about which relate to people's own experiences and about the growth. You know, the LT Museum is not just a collection of old buses and trains; it's the story of the development of London. So that's good stuff. But there is a problem, and you're right. I think there are two problems, one of which is that it may not be in our lifetimes, but it won't be long afterwards, that the supply of petrol, diesel, maybe even some of the ingredients of oil for engines and other things like brake linings and so on are going to be much more difficult because technology is moving on. And actually, what that means is that we need to do what the bus inspectors have started to do, which is to look at the grading of historic vehicles and decide which ones really need to be kept, because you've got several old vehicles in various conditions, or rather our charity has two route masters. They're lovely and I'm really proud of them, but they're not much different from the other 1,400 in captivity, and it isn't likely that they'll all survive. So grading the ones that we've got and making sure that the ones which are most tell the best stories are kept is a good thing. The other thing, of course, is that modern technology is going to be much harder to keep, because if you want to keep an electric bus, you're going to have to find a way of having batteries that will be durable over, you know, 50 or 60 years, and also keeping the computer controls, you know, the electronic controls going in a way that enables it to run. And I think, you know, we're only a little way down that road, aren't we? What you know from the experience, particularly at London Bus Museum and also with the fleet at the road fleet at the London Transport Museum, is that what people want to do is not merely see them, they want to ride on them, you know? One of the things with these industries that is really interesting is that the level of interest in the history of the industry, what it now does, its wider social, political and economic contribution is very profoundly marked with many, many people. It isn't just a job, is it? That's the truth of it. You know, there are people we both know for whom it's just a job and it's just a way of making money. But for many, many people, they realise how interesting it is and what a contribution it makes. And I think that's brilliant, actually. I think, it, you know, the fact is that connectivity drives growth, jobs and houses, but actually connectivity is interesting and transport is interesting, and it's so great that that's true, isn't it? We couldn't be having this discussion if we were both foreign exchange traders, could we?
Well, that's a great way to finish. You and I celebrating not being foreign exchange traders.
So this has been Lunch with Leon with my special guest, Peter Lord Hendy. And what a fantastic episode this has been. And I'm really grateful for Peter for coming to the show. So Lunch with Leon is a podcast produced and delivered by me in association with Passenger Transport Magazine. Please, if you're interested, of course, as you must be, to listen to this podcast, if you're interested in transport, then please do check in with Passenger Transport Magazine, which you can do at passengertransport.co.uk. As I say, this has been an absolutely brilliant episode. We'll be back with another episode very soon. And all that remains for me to do is to thank our special guest, Peter Hendy. And as we say goodbye, here is an AI-generated song about Peter, me, and the podcast.
Thank you very much.
In the cafe, tales begin, as human cups in hand. Reflecting on the roads we've been, guided by city hand. Leon, the host of charm and grace, welcomes guests anew. While Lord Hendy shares his place, his wisdom shines on through. Sits at the table, eyes with a glitz so bright. Stories of trains and stories of might. With Lord Hendy, tales of rails unfold. Centuries chat in episodes foretold. Cheers to the voices, echoes of the past. Episode 100, memories amassed.